The Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. Every coffee lover knows that the key to the best coffee is fresh roasted beans. Most coffee you buy in the grocery store or your local coffee shop was roasted months before it got to you. Sparkplug Coffee is roasted to order in Toronto and delivered right to your door anywhere in Canada while the coffee is fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug offers plenty of variety and grinds to suit any taste. Their scientific roast process ensures consistency so that each blend maintains its flavor profile. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in by going to sparkplug.coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hiya, lovely listeners, and we thank you for hitting play on the Top 100 Project. As we review the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 123, yes, 123, most extraordinary American movies. Right off the bat, let's warn you that spoilers from top to tail are on the way. I am Ryan Ellis with the woman who occasionally sings alone on grassy hilltops, my esteemed wife, Bev.
That's Do-Re-Mi.
Nice. Get thee to a nunnery. And then quit. We'll warn you off the bat as well that there's sounds around our place more than usual, all kinds of low droning type noises, and Fox is over in the corner making his noise, so if you hear those things, we don't have a proper sound studio for this. But back to the task at hand, the coming attraction trivia for this week's film, The Sound of Music. It is the third biggest hit of all time when adjusted for inflation. How many live-action musicals from the AFI's Top 100 list are on Box Office Mojo's Top 200 Biggest Hits Ever when adjusted for inflation?
West Side Story was a big hit.
Mm-hmm, that's one of them.
Can't be Cabaret.
Not Cabaret.
And Not Singing in the Rain.
Nope. We've covered them very recently.
My Fair Lady?
My Fair Lady.
And what number is it?
Sound of Music.
Yeah.
That's the third.
What number is My Fair Lady?
My Fair Lady's 56th. West Side Story, 68th. And I didn't include the cartoons, animated films that could be considered musicals, because there's a few of those on there. That's why I said live action. I thought it was a very important distinction to make. They have certainly endured. They were huge hits then, and re-releases made them huger hits even more so.
Very popular films.
All right, well, the 67th Top 100 Project film, The Sound of Music, was 55th on AFI's 1998 Top 100, between All Quiet on the Western Front and MASH, then danced up 15 spots to 40th on the 2007 list, straddled by Dr. Strangelove and King Kong. Sound of Music premiered in New York on March 2nd, 1965, then Fox released it in L.A. on March the 10th. An absolutely huge hit, as we just said. It was a blockbuster in 1965 and kept being one through the many re-releases. And Bev will describe The Sound of Music for you with the skinny.
Julie Andrews is Maria, a peppy young woman who leaves an Austrian convent to become the caregiver to a widower's 7 kids. The widower is Captain Georg von Trapp, played by Christopher Plummer, a strict Navy man who is raising his children with discipline and without much affection. Maria's effervescence brings about 1 or 10 changes in the von Trapp family.
Or in a nutshell, Seaman gives up chance to end up a sexy rich chick so he can marry the help.
I think I said after the movie, when Jude Law leaves his fiancée for the nanny, everyone gives him a hard time, but Captain Von Trapp, everyone cheers.
He's the hero of heroes. All right, Bev, 85% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes, 91% of audiences are fans of this movie. What about you?
This film is all kinds of things that I normally hate. It's saccharine and antiseptically innocent. It's way too long. But I loved it anyway, with my heart. I think it was the combination of the scenery and the songs, which are all standards now, and Julie Andrews' performance, which was about as charming as it gets. The woman has a 1 in 1,000,000 screen presence.
Yeah, she runs the gamut, though, from sunny to mildly concerned.
Oh, dude, it's so vapid. There's no meat to it. There's no scandal to it.
Even
it
when the Nazis are chasing them down.
Dude.
She's mildly concerned.
Yeah. You never really worry about them. You know the Von Trapps are going to be fine. They're going to be fine.
Well, the good movie makes that seem like it maybe won't turn out for them. And I think Robert Wise, who's the director, plays off that tension pretty well in the end when they're being stalked.
Yeah.
I have not seen this movie in so long. I'd forgotten. I knew that they were being stalked by the Nazis in some way, but I'd forgotten that sequence happens. And the little girl says something like, "Should we sing some songs, Maria?" And God, it's like that scene in Walking Dead from, what, earlier this year, last year, whatever it was, about the girl who threatens to choke the baby out for making noises so the zombies won't come get them. And you can almost understand the mentality. It's either her or all of us. Well, it just got dark, didn't it?
My mind did not go there at all.
Shut up, kid. Shut up.
It's more like, why don't we stop being nice to this stupid little girl?
Well, you know what, though? You know what, though? These are the dumbest Nazis who ever Nazied.
They're really bad at not seeing. They really are.
They're so trusting. They find them in the middle of the night trying to run away in their car. Clearly that's what they're doing. And yet don't really keep a very good eye on them if you think about it. They let them get away. They really shouldn't have. If there was no chance, they weren't worried at all about the captain running away. That'd be one thing, but they are. Anyway, we're getting to the details of this whole thing. And I want to get in the broad strokes. I'm going to quote Pauline Kael. I haven't done this a lot because, as we said a few weeks ago, it's hard to find her reviews online. At least it's been hard for me to find them. But she said, it's a sugar-coated lie people seem to want to eat. And the sickly, goody-goody songs.
Yeah.
I don't think I disagree with that, but I do enjoy the songs. I don't find myself singing them days later after we saw the film, but they're good.
Her criticism is totally accurate. And it's a thing that I usually hate about movies. And I will go on to criticize lots of other films on this list for being overly sweet, for being too afraid to...
Your biggest problem with Spielberg seems to be that.
Yes, yeah. He pulls his punches and he babies the audience. He draws it out for them way too much. Maybe what I liked about Sound of Music, I mean, you have to admit, no matter what, chances are you grew up with these songs, listening to them, singing them. I was a little girl. Me and my sisters used to sing these songs. I don't remember the movie at all, if I ever saw it when I was a kid, but I'm so familiar with that music, and it's been kind of a part of culture in my life, my whole life, so I have these nice associations with it. That helps a lot.
Okay, let me do what I've done before I get to my yes or no, because I don't think it's a bad movie, and I would put it on the list. Is it one of my 100 favorite movies? No, but that's never been what this is about, at least not for me. This has been about using the AFI's criteria and my own feelings, how the movie gained in esteem as years have gone on. So here's the stats part of it first. I gave you a lot of them already. We said it was third in box office mojo. The only two movies ahead of it are Gone with the Wind and Star Wars. Talk about lofty company. The success of the film helped Fox from nearly going under after Cleopatra, not long before, with this massive overbudget. That's a very infamous film that nearly destroyed them. We talked about how Ben-Hur was a big gamble by MGM, and they sunk all their money into it because they figured, well, we're either going to go out with a bang, do the best we can and fail miserably, or we're going to succeed like they did, and they're resurrected from it. Sound of Music was kind of the same idea. One of the unfortunate influences of that, though, is that Hollywood, especially Fox in particular, they made a lot of these types of movies. They went whole hog on overblown musicals in the rest of the 60s and probably even into the 70s, but definitely the next 4 or 5 years of the 60s. Although the business was getting grittier and they deglossed, if you will, soon after. And we're going to cover some of these movies right away. After we do Dr. Zhivago, if we get to the 66, 67 timeframe, and certainly by 69, we're getting into that Easy Rider's Raging Bull territory.
We said this about My Fair Lady, too, that these two movies are such total antiquated throwbacks. By the time you're watching all these other films from the same era, it's almost embarrassing how much they stick out as if they're from another time. There's nothing really modern or fresh about them at
they
all.
They belonged when they were set, especially Sound of Music, because it is set the very late 30s. Obviously, as most people who know this movie would know, it ends up being about the war and the Nazis and all that stuff, as we've been saying. But yeah, it might as well have been made then. A few more numbers I want to say first. We talked about this recently. A film released in March can win the Best Picture Oscar. And it's happened with other ones too, not often. Silence of the Lambs in 1991 was released in February, right around Valentine's Day. So there's that aspect for it. It managed to maintain about a year later when the awards would have come out in 66. And it's even been remarkably popular when it's shown on TV. That's maybe not a surprise, but it's one of those movies that does belong on the big screen. We at least have the advantage of watching a widescreen print on a 42-inch TV. People back when this movie would have been on TV in the late 60s and into the 70s would have had those tiny little things.
And like I already said, the scenery in this film was a big draw for me.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. We are booking a ticket to Salzburg.
Well, it starts off with those travelogue opening shots. Yeah. I'd forgotten all about that. The movie doesn't really have any of the music before we get to the famous shot of Maria on the hillside singing the title song. But for about a minute before that, you're seeing shots of various parts of Salzburg.
Yeah, for a long time. And they're gorgeous.
Yeah, very pretty to look at. Okay, one more point I want to make as far as that the AFI thinks of this kind of stuff, though. I'm not going to rattle off all the lists just yet. I'll do that later. But it wouldn't surprise me if they had this in the top 10 or at least the top 25 based on their criteria. It's remained popular over time. It's one of the biggest hits of all time. It won all kinds of awards at the time. It's on other lists, and we're going to get to those at the end. And people still know the movie. They love the movie. They enjoy the movie. And they do forgive a lot of the problems, as you did.
Mm-hmm.
All those things would have said, for me, the movie belongs even higher than it is.
Yeah, I'm really surprised that it's as low as it is.
Mm.
Because it's in popular consciousness at least as much as, say, Wizard of Oz. They both have their faults, but they're both such a part of our pop culture consciousness.
I think Wizard of Oz is more influential. I think it's one of the most influential movies that's ever been made. in so many ways.
And at the time that it was made, it was actually fresh and innovative, whereas you really can't say that about The Sound of Music.
No. The biggest thing about The Sound of Music is it does what West Side Story did, and My Fair Lady does not, and Swing Time did not, and some of our other musicals did not. As much as I love Sing the Rain, it doesn't do it either. But it takes an important subject, gang violence in the inner city of New York in West Side Story. Here you lead into war. And not only war, but you have to side with the Nazis, who are taking over your country, and then, of course, that's why they run away, because he's supposed to go off and captain some ship somewhere, fighting against the side that he wants to be with.
How do you solve a problem like the Nazis?
Run away! They take the advice of Monty Python, they run away!
Like we already said, though, they may be dealing with a pretty serious subject, but they sure do tone it down a lot. They sure do make it as safe as possible. Mm-hmm. They have a problem with the Nazis, but it seems like the only reason that they do is because they're patriotic towards Austria, and they aren't particularly fond of Germans. It's nothing to do with Nazis and their philosophy at all. It doesn't even come up.
I don't know if people necessarily knew what the Nazis were going to do or what they even had done.
But they knew they
in
hated.
The late 30s.
They knew that they were intolerant. The Nazis did run on a platform of anti-Semitism.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, of course, if you could go back in time, you'd change it from even happening. But if you couldn't change something, you just wanted to see what it was like to live in an era. There are tons of things I'd like to see from the long ago past. But one of them would be to see what Europe was like before any of this crap really started happening over there. And the Nazis really started taking over. Were people doing the whole thing like, okay, he's not really serious. Hitler's not really going to do this stuff. He's not really going to kill people. He's not really going to round them up and make them live in concentration camps and do all the terrible things that he and his people ended up doing. Were people burying their heads in the sand? The Remains of the Day, we talked about that recently. The movie has nothing to do with Sound of Music, but that one takes place between World War I and World War II. And Anthony Hopkins' boss has a line, something along the lines of, you don't keep your foot on somebody's throat when you've beaten them, meaning the Germans in the First World War, leading the Second World War. And he was an appeaser, this guy in the movie, the James Fox character.
And he was right. Because that was what brought about the Third Reich. The unfair treatment of the unfair, but let's say harsh treatment of the Germans after World War I.
The flip side of that was that people like him who appeased the Germans ended up breeding the Nazi Party because they gave them enough power and leverage to do what they wanted to do, and they went obviously way too far.
Ay, ay, ay.
What a deep black hole we're entering into here.
I know.
A movie called The Sound of Music, which is such a beloved musical.
Which dealt with the Nazis while treading as lightly as humanly possible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were afraid to offend Nazis a little bit. they were like, let's make this as inoffensive as possible.
20 years after they'd been knocked out of power, almost 20 years. Let's get back to wisecracks and fun stuff. So it was based on a Rodgers and Hammerstein stage musical, and the true tale of the story of the Trapp family singers. I guess the Vaughn part, I was reading about how that wasn't really a name he even went by anymore.
Yeah, well, he wasn't supposed to, legally, because he didn't have the title anymore.
It's like a royalty kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
he wasn't royal,
like a
but
lord or something.
Along those lines, yeah. And Maria, the actual Maria, wrote that. And speaking of the real Maria, she wasn't in love with, we're going to call him Georg. I could swear they were calling him Gal. His friends were calling him Gal, and his fiancé, the one I mentioned in the beginning. But you thought they were saying Gal.
Georg, yeah.
Okay.
I could be
Gal.
Wrong.
If I say Gal on this podcast, that's what I'm talking about. It would be Christopher Plummer's character. But the real Maria and Georg weren't in love when they married. And she wasn't apparently very peppy either. One of the kids said she was bipolar by the sound of what he was describing.
They described her as having a terrible, unpredictable temper. She would fly into rages. She would have, I guess, the manic periods where she would make them all play clothes and make them climb on trees and fall out of boats and do all these just delightful things. And then the other side would show its face. Mr. Hyde would come out sometimes too, but they didn't show that in the movie.
Well, because she's running the gamut from
yeah.
A to maybe E as far as emotions go.
And apparently Georg, or whatever we shall call him, was never the disciplinarian that he was portrayed in the film. He was always a kind father, but that was just...
There's no drama, though.
Exactly.
Because the biggest drama in the movie is not the Nazis, it is the switch. And he has one of those moments, and Christopher Plummer plays it very well, I thought. But he has one of those moments where he goes from being a jerk to being this wonderfully accepting person in the space of one song. He overhears his kids singing, he witnesses them singing, and he goes from never to always.
Except in public!
Right, yeah. Well, that's another thing about the singing, is that they only did sing as a family when they were broke.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about entertaining people or let's see what we can do with our talents. It was more about we need money.
Yeah.
We can take advantage of this talent we seem to have.
They weren't wealthy in real life. The Von Trapp family was wealthy once upon a time, but Georg had, I don't want to say squandered his fortune, but had some bad luck in business. They were middle class. They weren't poor, but they needed to perform. They did it because they needed the money.
And the father, Plummer, his only AFI film, he was also in Star Trek VI as one of the better villains Star Trek ever had, I thought, in that one, The Undiscovered Country. My favorite role of his would be in The Insider, where he plays Mike Wallace. He won the Oscar for Beginners a couple of years ago, and he's been in the business for 60 years, and he's still going. He's an old fella. He's not a fan of his own movie, or at least he wasn't. He called it The Sound of Mucus.
Good one, Christopher.
Although he likes Julie Andrews personally. Mm-hmm. I think he did then. He certainly does now. I read somewhere how they were all, at least the surviving cast members, were on one of the talk shows, The View or something.
I think it was Oprah.
Oprah, okay, yeah. Not that long ago. And I believe he was one of them, so he must have some liking for the movie, or else he would have done that. He wouldn't have been obligated to. And a common theme we've been having in musicals lately, he was also dubbed, like so many of the men were, and the women were in other movies. As was Peggy Wood, who plays, what is it, Mother Superior, whatever they call her in this movie? Mm-hmm. And she was nominated for an Oscar, supporting actress, incidentally.
Even though this scandal of dubbing the singing voices is what supposedly robbed Audrey Hepburn of her Oscar nomination and Natalie Wood for West Side Story, right? Mm-hmm.
And yet Peggy Wood gets the nomination for a very small role, and that's not necessarily a problem that she wasn't in the movie that much. Sometimes the best work is 5 or 10 minutes of screen time.
I don't know. Is she that great, though? Does she really stand out that much to you?
No, definitely not. I didn't know who she was. When I was doing what I've been calling my pre-search on the movie through the Wikipedia and IMDb pages, I saw her name, and I didn't know who they were talking about until I had to look up what her actual credit was. And I still didn't remember her in the movie anyway until we saw it. And then, of course, it becomes clear. She only made a few movies in her whole long career, and this was her final one, actually. And as I said, she got the nomination at least. But how are we not talking about the biggest star of the whole thing, Julie Andrews?
Oh, yeah. She's wonderful. Her look of affection and longing. A pretty unlikable character. Georg is not a really lovable character, but she makes me love him.
Do you believe any better than with My Fair Lady that this love story makes any sense, though? We didn't believe that love story. Do we believe this one?
They make me believe. He's not perfect, but he's not an irredeemable monster. In fact, he does change. He does soften up. As much as she says later on in the movie, oh, I fell in love with you the second you blew that stupid whistle, he becomes far more lovable later in the movie when he lightens up. And he's got the kids that she's in love with. She's kind of in love with the whole family.
She's in it more for the kids at the beginning, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Which is what the real Maria von Trapp said, that she was crazy about the kids, and that's part of the reason why she married into
And she married for the old-fashioned reasons of security as well.
Yeah, because she didn't want to become a nun. Mm-hmm. That much was true.
And another character in the AFI list, we've seen so many of them in the late 50s, now into the 60s, and really through the whole list, I guess, that don't fit in anywhere. Now, she eventually does fit in with these people, but at first she doesn't. I guess at the beginning, actually, we don't see where she came from, what she was doing before, but she's definitely not going to work as a nun. It's never going to make sense.
How do you solve a problem like Maria?
And there you go. And that's, I think, the first song after the actual Sound of Music. And
I like how the nuns cannot abide delight. They're like, get that out of here.
Yeah, she has something to offer them, too. She could at least be their cleaning person or something.
She doesn't seem like she's lazy by any means. Mm-hmm. They could put her to work as if the end of the world that she likes to sing. Singing! God hates that! Get out!
And speaking of which, and speaking of dubbing a few minutes ago, Marnie Nixon finally gets to be on screen as one of the nuns.
Yeah.
I didn't know which one she was. I didn't look that closely to find out who she was, but she's one of the singing nuns in that number in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
So we've actually now had her in 3 movies, which is more than a lot of the huge stars we're going to have on this list. West Side Story dubbing and My Fair Lady dubbing. And now she sang and appeared briefly in this one. But back to Julie Andrews. Her ineptitude at being a nun wins her a family. Mm-hmm. My original nutshell was more about that she gets a ready-made family.
They immediately start calling her mother. Even the teenagers that, by all rights, should be pretty surly.
Yeah, they're a little too accepting. They have a right at that age, as puberty is hitting them, to struggle with things a little bit more.
Yeah, they're adolescent. They should be more rebellious.
And the little kids are just naturally rebellious, I guess. But we see little evidence of the children's tyranny towards governesses, the way that they talk about that.
No, because she wins them over immediately with her Julie Andrews charm.
Well, they warned her in what seems like less than a day. All it takes is a thunderstorm. Much like Fox, he would be messed up by that. I love you now!
Yeah, really. That's true. That's true.
And then that leads into the song, My Favorite Things.
Yeah, that's a catchy tune. That's a pretty good one.
I remember when I saw this movie the first time, the one thing about it I didn't forget were the songs. I was maybe not singing them, but they stayed in my head for many months after.
Oddly, My Favorite Things has become something of a Christmas standard now. I hear it all the time at Christmas time. Yeah.
There must be some kind of line about Christmas in there. I don't remember.
Brown paper packages tied up with string. I think it's supposed to imply presents.
Oh, okay. But then again, how can you not fall in love with her when you are wearing uniforms, but then she makes them fun? Different ones, and they're fun.
Is it just me, or the uniforms actually look like they would be far more comfortable to play in than the lederhosen and those dresses? The dress that the oldest daughter is wearing is tighter than a corset on her. How could that possibly be comfortable to play in?
Well, and this must be an homage of some sort to Gone with the Wind, because she makes clothes out of curtains.
Oh, that's a
and
good
Scarlett
point.
Had done that in Gone with the Wind.
I totally forgot that detail.
And we've now said Gone with the Wind 2 or 3 times in this podcast because that is the biggest hit of all time when adjusted for inflation. But again, back to Julie Andrews. The only AFI film she made, along with Plumber, and only one for each of them, She debuted in Mary Poppins. We talked about that when we did My Fair Lady, and that won her an Oscar. She did not win back-to-back awards, though. She lost it to another Julie Christie, who was in Darling in 1965. I won the award for that. She wasn't nominated for Dr. Zhivago, our next Top 100 film. Look at all these links and connections.
It's funny how Julie Andrews' two most famous films are back-to-back, 1 year to the next, and in both she's playing a nanny.
Extremely similar character, too. Yeah, with a very similar arc, in fact. She's got to change a stodgy man to be better to his kids and therefore be better. Well, I guess in Mary Poppins, she doesn't end up with him, so it's not better to her. There's no romance there, but at least be better to the kids.
Yeah.
Andrews is also known for a ton of movies, really, but Victor Victoria, where she's very good, and the Shrek sequels, where she plays Fiona's mother, at least in voice, anyway. And, of course, The Princess Diaries. I'm not a big fan of those. I've never even seen them, actually, The Princess Diaries. I don't know anything about them, but they were pretty big hits. And in this movie, she's a rebel with a cause, because she's out to make nuns and children happy. You're not tearing me apart! Two other key members of the cast to talk about, for sure, would be Eleanor Parker and Charmian, or Charmaine. It's spelled C-H-A-R-M-I-A-N, Carr. So let's go with Charmian. And she played Liesel. Eleanor Parker played the Baroness. Never hear the name Baroness, I always think of G.I. Joe, but that's just me. And I thought she twirled her mustache a lot, which I'd said during the movie when we paused it to take a washroom break. You didn't agree.
I totally disagree. As villains go, she was this lovely, complex, believable one. In fact, I wouldn't call her a villain at all. She's kind of the victim in this.
She's trying to ditch those kids and ditch Maria so she can take over. And Mary guy she's in love. That's
happening. You don't think she's in love?
It's one of those things we've seen a few other times. Swing Time is the best example of this. Where you've fallen for somebody else, that's okay. Go off and be with him or her. In this case, her. I'm okay with that.
She did fight for him. She tried to lose Maria. She tried to convince Maria to leave by being honest with Maria and saying, I know you're in love with the captain. Maria kind of decides on her own that it's inappropriate. That was pretty villainous, though. It wasn't villainous. It was kind of her being honest with her, saying, I know you don't want this. You want to be a nun. So you're in love with the captain. You should probably leave. And yes, of course, she has her self-interest. But I think anybody looking at things from her side would say, oh, that's actually a pretty kind way to deal with this. Because, of course, she's going to want to marry the captain. It's once she realizes the captain is totally in love with Maria and that her plan has failed, and she says, okay, I don't want this man. I mean, I want this man, but I'm not going to ever really have this man. So I'm going to give him up because this isn't right.
And she'll play act that she doesn't actually want him at all.
He breaks up with her, and she's got the tears in her eyes. She's like, I didn't even care. I was going to break up with you. You can't fire me. I quit. And she, you know, she leaves. But she gives him her blessing, which I just didn't see in the same way as Swing Time, where he was like, all right, you crazy kids, have fun. You know, he just didn't care all of a sudden, even though he was fighting
for Ginger Rogers. Because the movie was over, they just wanted to work out.
Exactly. I didn't feel that from her. It felt believable.
Well, this is definitely better than that.
She had the complexity.
Yeah, okay, that's like, better than that, but I still thought she was mustache twirling more than you did.
She wasn't doing anything wrong for the first hour and a half of the film. She comes in and she's kind of trying with the kids, and no, she's not amazing with them, but he knew her. She seems like she was a pretty good catch. She had a nice social life over there.
And if she heard the stories about how bad they were to the previous governesses, she wouldn't have trusted them anyway. How could she?
Yeah, that's a good point. So the kids are evil, the Baroness is good. Yeah, I'm glad we settled this.
Well, the Baroness is Eleanor Parker. She was in The Man with the Golden Arm with Sinatra 45 years before this, and she worked for 50 years in the business. Not a lot of other big credits I could find. She only died in December of last year. Nice long life. The younger star, the very beautiful Charmian Carr, was in a TV movie in 1966, the year after Sound of Music, that never acted again. And a lot of the other children in this movie, of the how many were boys, how many were girls?
It's two boys, five girls.
Yeah, easy trivia question. I have a lot of trivia for this one. It's one of the few I had. And she is the oldest one. A lot of the other children didn't act again. So I don't know why she didn't keep on going. She wasn't dubbed. She's got a decent voice. She's very pretty. Great. She's like a decent little actress. Yeah, she's got probably the third most screen time in the whole movie behind Anderson Plummer.
And she has that beautiful romance with Rolf.
But interesting with him is that there's a very jarring part of the movie, again, getting back to the Nazis for a minute, where you see a teenage boy giving the Heil. And he knows what's involved. He knows what this is. Well, maybe he doesn't know the murder that's going to come with all the Nazis, but he knows he's on the side of, we're taking over and blank you.
I loved this part of the film that they have this romance initially and it really looks like it's going in this obvious direction. And then even when they initially put the wrench in it that the Nazis come, but when he does the Heil, as an audience, you're never going to forgive that. You're never going to be okay with him ending up with Liesel. And they cut that romance short and she's a little bit heartbroken, but they just kind of move on. I love that that didn't play out the way it predictably would have.
That's true.
Yeah.
And like I say, it was a jarring moment to see that. A very sobering moment in a movie that's so light and fluffy for most of it.
In a film that doesn't really feel like it accurately depicts the horrors of war, that was at least one thing where they didn't pull their punches.
We see the Nazis a fair amount on the Top Nerd Project. We saw them, I guess the last time would be Casablanca. And they're indirectly referenced in war movies a lot of the time because characters coming back from war, It's a Wonderful Life, Place in the Sun, and many others, best years of our lives, obviously, they came back from fighting either the Nazis or the Japanese and their various cohorts. So it's a theme we come to over and over again, but we're going to get a little more directly. In fact, our final musical on the Top Nerd Project, Cabaret, has singing and Nazis. That's almost all that movie is, as I remember. Another movie I don't remember much at all. I wasn't a big fan of it.
Well, World War II and the Nazis, they're like one of those rare historical events that seems to perfectly fit into formulaic storytelling, where you have a really clear villain and a really clear hero, and the heroes beat the villains. And it all kind of happens in a short period of time. For a moment, it looked like all was lost. And then the Allies bucked up and won the war after all. You know, thank you, Russian winters. Or
Well, speaking of inspirational, the BBC planned to air this movie to boost morale if there had ever been a nuclear strike.
That's right.
I don't know if they still do plan that, but they at one time did.
And the soundtrack, a lot of the songs in the soundtrack were part of the broadcast that they had planned in the event of total disaster. Lighten up, guys. We still have kitten whiskers. Or do we? Let's just pretend we do.
Wasn't that long ago we covered Dr. Strangelove, one of the darkest movies, as hilarious as it is, but one of the darkest movies certainly on our list, and maybe one of the darkest of all time.
When you go in the mineshaft, you gotta take Sound of Music with you.
Maybe it's interesting that we're going from My Fair Lady to this, because this has the same fluffery that My Fair Lady does for a while. Then it gets to the heavy stuff at the end, the last hour, maybe only about a half an hour. And Dr. Zhivago are one after this, tough material a lot of the time, and the late 60s films, as we said, generally got to very adult material. Getting back to the children actors, including Carr, the lovely Liesel, she and Christopher Plummer dug each other, and even though they were father and daughter in the movie only 13 years apart, I don't know if they actually had an affair, but they definitely ran into each other, is what I was reading. Did you read that part?
No, I didn't see that. You told me about that.
Good for him. He's one of those people that looks a lot different in the 60s than he does now. I don't think in a bad way. He's a decent-looking older guy. And yeah, he's got himself in good shape. He's been around for, what did I say, 60 years?
And I don't know how old Carr was, but he was a pretty handsome gentleman back then.
Mm-hmm. One more thing I want to say about the kids. I don't want to talk about all of them because most of them, as I said before, didn't really have any kind of career after this movie. But four pretty big names auditioned to be one of the kids. Two boys, two girls. Kurt Russell and Richard Dreyfuss.
Wow.
Auditioned to be a boy in the movie. And Liza Minnelli and Mia Farrow.
Way.
Farrow would have had to have been for Liesel, I guess, because she did Rosemary's Baby 3 years later. She certainly wasn't young enough to be one of the other ones. All right, we got to talk about the songs and the Sound of Music.
Yeah,
very specifically.
Yeah.
To get more screenings in South Korea, one theater owner cut out the musical numbers. If you didn't have the music in this movie, then what would be the point?
There's a thunderstorm, it's over.
Let's cut out all the Jedi stuff and Star Wars. We gotta get more screenings in there. People will enjoy it anyway.
Nobody really likes Julie Andrews for her singing voice.
So as famous as the songs are, and as popular, there is an unnecessary reprisal of every one of them.
Yeah, and especially that encore presentation when they're doing the festival. It's so strange that they wouldn't have saved one of the songs or had an original song for that particular performance. They shortened the goodbye song, at least.
But the man who is their manager to make them sing all these songs, Richard Hayden, he's so dead. He doesn't escape with them at the end.
Dude, Ron, the Nazis are going to do the worst things to you.
Well, then again, they're pretty dumb.
They don't
dumb.
Care for managers of musical acts
yes.
over there in Nazi Germany.
Especially ones who seem to be of the men-loving persuasion.
Yes.
As you implied. You're probably right.
Maybe the Baroness could be his beard.
Run, Richard, run! No, I mean he's dead because he helped them get away. Or they would have accused him of it, whether he did it or not.
Oh, I see.
The director of this film, Robert Wise, his second AFI after West Side Story. He also edited Citizen Kane. Not a bad resume. He's got a ton of other movies. He was a pretty good journeyman director. William Wyler, though, was the original choice for the film, and he almost did it, but he wanted it to be too serious. He ended up doing The Collector in 1965 instead. A very low-key movie. What did you think of Wise's direction?
Well, I must have liked it, because he made
it.
A film that I should have hated. Lovable. Visually, that's a real standout part of the film. The scenery and even the dance numbers, you know, Do-Re-Mi, them running all over Salzburg from one place to the next and their clothing changes and everything, the light, the sets, the costumes, it's beautiful to look at. So it really helps make the film. It could have had so many pacing problems, but he manages to keep it moving. It's episodic, so you don't feel the length of it quite as bad as I did for My Fair Lady, where it just feels like an epic long film. This film is longer, but because it kind of plays out one scene at a time and not it's one whole story arc.
Yeah, that's true. It didn't feel like a slog. I wasn't bored.
You're not waiting for it to end the way it happened with a lot of other films. And I think part of that is probably wise and knowing how to direct an episodic film so it doesn't feel too much like that. They end that teenage romance. They have the wedding 2/3 through the film. They don't play it out in a typical way, although I guess that the stage musical would have done that work for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if there's one achievement that the direction had, it was letting Julie Andrews do what she did, but also visually, he really made a beautiful film.
And Wyler directed Ben-Hur, which definitely had pacing problems.
Yeah.
Feel how long that movie is.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually.
So maybe he would have been the wrong choice for that reason, too.
Even though it was also an episodic film, and yet it really felt long.
Mm-hmm.
Another film where the worst part is the very last act.
That's true of a lot of modern movies, though, too, where it's become this, not necessarily always explosions, but it's the same basic kind of formula at the end. Well, Wise's writer was Ernest Lehman, and we've talked about him a lot the last while. He's been writing and producing a ton of movies for us. North by Northwest, West Side Story. And he's going to do Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf as a writer and producer in just a few weeks. He adapted, of course, the stage musical by Lindsay and Krauss. And I mentioned Roger and Hammerstein, all these people involved. Urban Kostal, I guess how you say his name, who did West Side Story and Mary Poppins. He was a composer for those films. He also was involved. So you've got, what, five pretty big names involved in the music in one way or another. Not just the composer, but the guy who wrote the stage stuff and the adapter and the friends and the buddies and all these big names. And as I said before, Fox did a lot of musicals after this one, wanting to replicate the success, and Roger and Hammerstein were often the people involved. And as we've been seeing more and more often lately, a producer, also a director, Robert Wise, produced this movie by himself. So as you would certainly know if you know anything about sound and music, it was Technicolor 70mm. We're not going to have too many more of those because Hollywood didn't want to make these huge budget type movies with that kind of technical requirement. It was so much more money to make a movie like that. The cinematographer shooting it was Ted McCord, who did The Treasure of Sierra Madre, one of my very favorites. And he did a lot of westerns, and he worked for 45 years. The editor, William Reynolds, will work on maybe the most famous movie of all time, really, when you come right down to it, The Godfather, cut that one too. And he worked with Wise quite a bit, doing The Day the Earth Stood Still, and he also edited The Sting. Those are pretty great titles right there. And the sets, we've mentioned him a lot lately, and we mentioned him again, Boris Levin, who did giant West Side Story and a ton of those Scorsese movies towards the end. Not the famous ones, The Goodfellas, The Taxi Drivers, and The Raging Bulls of the World, but a lot of his other films. Levin, again, created some pretty memorable sets.
Definitely. The sets are gorgeous. He did a great job.
I already mentioned the influence on Hollywood itself and certainly on Fox with the way they kept making these kinds of musicals, trying to replicate the success. A couple other influences would be The Sound of Music Live on NBC with Carrie Underwood, which whenever you type in Sound of on the IMDb, that comes up as one of the first options you could be clicking on. And, of course, the countless parodies, especially of the opening scene, where the hills are alive with The Sound of Music. And, by the way, this movie starts on a hill and it ends in the hills.
Yeah, that's right.
As they run away, run away. It's definitely a bittersweet ending.
Yeah, it's true. It's weird they've that lost it ends their home. Where it does.
They've lost everything except the clothes on their back, but at least they're together. The nine of them are going to survive, you hope. We know they did in reality.
Yeah, in reality, they went to Manhattan. They ended up in America, and they kept performing, and that's how they got famous, and that's why people were interested in their story. It's strange that they don't do any of that part. You think that would be a more interesting story than what you see in Salzburg.
They could even just key at the end of the movie, just one title card that says what they went on to do. So many movies do that. And for the rest of the story,
they died on the way to their home planet.
Okay, now here's a substantial amount of things to mention in the awards section. The 5 Oscars, Best Picture, we've seen a lot of them lately. Best Director, so Wise took home awards for both of those. The editing, the sound, and the music. That seems appropriate, the sound and the music. And 5 other nominations for Andrews as Best Actress, the supporting actress Peggy Wood, the cinematography, the sets, and the costumes. The last 3 of those, cinematography, sets, and costumes, it lost to Dr. Zhivago. Love when we can promote our next film or soon-to-come AFI films. It took a long while for The Sound of Music to make the National Film Registry, and it did that in 2001.
I couldn't believe that it took them that long to get around to The Sound of Music. I always understood this to be one of the most beloved films Hollywood ever made. But maybe it's because it's a really Austrian film, and it has English stars. Maybe a beloved film made by Americans, but do people who are preserving the heritage of America really care about this film in that sense?
Maybe not. Lawrence of Arabia, as we said when we did that one, is not really an American film at all.
Yeah. Third Man would be another great example.
Yeah, pretty much just Wells and the producer Selznick.
Doesn't take place in America, isn't really about America that much.
And there are others, for sure, on this list that are very debatably American films. All right, so the AFI representation, 41st on the top 100 Cheers for The Sound of Music, 27th on the top 100 Passions. That's one I don't agree with because I don't really buy the romance. But you did. Three top 100 songs.
Do, Re, Mi.
Was 88th.
These are a few of my favorite things.
Was 64th. I think it could have been even higher than that. And the title song.
The hills are alive with the sound of music.
Not bad. Like I said, I know, you often sing alone on hilltops. You're proving it.
I sound just like Julie Andrews. I know, guys. It wasn't her. It was me.
Carrie Underwood is out of a job.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure I'll star in the next remake.
And that song was 10th on the top 100 songs list. And the movie was 4th on the top 25 musicals. So there you go. A lot of AFI love, not surprisingly. How did this movie not climb a lot higher than it did? We've talked so much about movies that took that skyrocket between lists. City Lights, The Searchers, Vertigo. We're going to cover Raging Bull as well, had a pretty big rise. Sound of Music had an okay rise.
I wouldn't put this film in my own personal top 25.
No, I wouldn't either.
Considering how popular it is. And I always assumed that it was a top 25 type film. I just know so many people who think it's wonderful and culturally iconic. I was really surprised to see how low it was on the list.
I know a few people who say this is their favorite movie.
Really?
Period. Yeah. They're not film snobs, but that doesn't matter. If somebody puts this kind of movie that's this old now
on their... It's just so beloved.
So parting thoughts then.
Well, I guess my biggest complaint about the film is that it's just so clean and inoffensive that it's a little hard to talk about, isn't it?
Yeah, we disagree on this, but we've definitely had stronger arguments about other movies we disagreed
it's
with.
It's really not very meaty. You can't sink your teeth into it as something to discuss, I suppose, but it's sure fun and...
delightful.
Warm. It would give me warm fuzzies a little bit.
Will you watch it again?
Not for a long time.
So that says a lot then, yeah. Too. Rewatchability is one that's not in the criteria of the AFI's list. I think that's an important one.
It's a commitment of time.
That's part of the problem.
To begin with. I think I'd be way more likely to just download the soundtrack and listen to a few songs if I was tempted to see this movie again.
Sing the Rain and Wizard of Oz are still my favorite musicals, without a doubt. No contest, not even close. But this one's at least respectable. We have only got one more to do, and that's Cabaret. So that wraps up The Sound of Music. Next week, we take a break from the Top 100 Project to bring you the 7th edition of the Not 100 Project, where we cover a movie that didn't make the list. This time, the movie that was egregiously passed over by the AFI is a recently requested title, Al Pacino and Sidney Lumet's Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah, one of our listeners requested this one. I haven't seen this movie in many years, but I remember enjoying it. It's really kinetic and fun, fast-paced.
I mentioned recently on a podcast I did called Ryan Rambles, which I hope to do every week, and so far very few people have listened to it, but it's there forever at least. I talked about how Blue Velvet was going to be our next Not 100 project. That was, I thought, a definite go. But then I had a friend who wanted to hear Dog Day Afternoon. We thought, well, we can change it up, do whatever we want to do. So we moved up Dog Day from being next year to being this year.
We're very pliable people.
we do take requests.
We take suggestions quite easily.
Well, it'd be a fun movie to talk about. So, the coming attraction trivia for Dog Day Afternoon. Al Pacino's co-star and co-robber, John Cassell, only made a handful of films before dying prematurely of cancer. How many of his pictures made AFI's Top 100 list, and how many were at least nominated? First, you got to figure out how many he was in.
So for the answer to that, please tune in to our Not 100 podcast next week. If you'd like more trivia, links to some of the things that we talked about, and lots of other fun stuff, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What did you think of The Sound of Music? We'd love to hear what you think about this movie or any of the other films we've covered on the project. Please send us a message. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once again, we'd like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
I ain't gonna sing.
But I know what'll make you feel better. How about singing?
Nope.
It's ever so much fun.
All right. So long, farewell, arvidus, and good night.
And cut.